Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Siewert van Liende? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Siewert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
Voor je gaat luisteren, heel even dit. In de nieuwe podcast Veldheren neem ik, Jos de Groot, jou iedere donderdag mee voorbij de frontlijn in Oekraïne. Dat doe ik samen met generaals buitendienst Peter van Umm en Mart de Kruijf. Zij hebben één duidelijk doel: aan jou uitleggen hoe oorlog werkt. Volg Veldheren in jouw favoriete podcast-app.
Yeltsin told Clinton, Bill, give Europe to us. Give Europe to Russia. The United States is not a European power. We are both a European and an Asian power. And Clinton says, so you want Asia too? And Yeltsin, I'm quoting from memory here, and Yeltsin says, well, we'll discuss that, but give Europe to us.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 413. En welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
PG, deze week bestaat de NAVO, de Noord-Atlantische Verdragsorganisatie, 75 jaar. Dat werd de afgelopen dagen gevierd door de ministers van Buitenlandse Zaken op het NAVO-hoofdkwartier in Brussel. En over 3 maanden, in juli, in Washington, waar het verdrag in 1949 werd geboren. De NAVO wordt wel gezien als de meest succesvolle alliantie in de geschiedenis. Ze zorgt er al 75 jaar voor dat wij in West-Europa van oorlog verschoond blijven.
En sinds 20 jaar, bij sommige landen zelfs 25 jaar, ook voor landen in Midden- en Oost-Europa, voor wie na de tijd dat ze natuurlijk in het Warschau-pact zaten, het natuurlijk een ongelofelijke gebeurtenis was dat ze lid werden van de Noord-Atlantische Verdragsorganisatie. Jaap Doop Scheffer, die daar secretaris-generaal was, heeft zelfs verteld dat toen in 2004 een soort Big Bang was, met de Baltische landen, Roemenië en wat al niet, dat toen die vlaggen werden gehezen op het moment dat hij zei, ik heb in mijn hele leven geen grote ceremonie meegemaakt met zoveel huilende mannen. Hij zei, generaals, ministers, de tranen liepen die mensen over de wangen. Hij zei, toen begreep ik pas echt wat dit voor deze mensen betekende. Dat je als het ware bij zo'n alliantie hoort, waarbij je dus de veiligheid van je land met elkaar deelt.
Over de NAVO gaan we praten met de vrouw die bijna 14 jaar de belangrijkste woordvoerder was van die organisatie. En ook van de 2 secretarissen-generaal Anders Fogh Rasmussen en daarna Jens Stoltenberg, de huidige SG. Politico noemde haar al in 2016 een van de invloedrijkste vrouwen in Brussel. Ik heb het over Oana Lungescu.
Ja, zij is niet alleen daarom heel interessant. Dus een dame met een enorme statuur in Brussel en dus ook wereldwijd. Maar zij is een van die mensen die geboren is in zo'n land dat dus in 2004 pas lid werd, namelijk in Roemenië. Zij is dus geboren en opgegroeid en heeft eigenlijk haar jeugd doorgemaakt in misschien wel de meest vreselijke dictatuur die er in de naoorlogse jaren in Europa was. Ze werd ook zwaar onder druk gezet door zeg maar, de Stasi van daar, de Securitate, totdat ze naar het westen kon vertrekken en eigenlijk een soort tweede leven begon. Eerst in Duitsland en daarna in Londen en uiteindelijk in Brussel.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome to our podcast, Oana Lungescu. When Romania became a member in 2004, now 20 years ago, what did this mean for you as a person, as a woman from Romania?
It was a very emotional moment because I had been covering NATO and EU enlargement actually since 1997 in Brussels for the BBC. And when I first arrived in 97 at the BBC Brussels Bureau, you know, to look for stories that we were not covering, I said, we're not covering enlargement. And my BBC editor said, oh, what's that? Is it even going to happen?
You thought it was boring.
They thought it was boring. It was never going to happen. It was going to be too costly. So they said, okay, well, go on with it. And actually, back in 97, the question was not whether NATO was going to enlarge or not. The question was, is it going to be with three countries or with five? And as we know, as history unfolded, in the end, it was three countries that joined in 99, and that was Czechia, Hungary, and Poland, with Romania and Slovenia left for the next wave. So basically what happened in 2004 was a so-called Big Bang enlargement, the biggest enlargement in NATO history to date. And I was there at the old NATO headquarters covering the raising of the flag. And yeah, I think I even had a tear in my eye. And actually, I could see that some of the foreign ministers who had been negotiating the accession were also crying.
When you look at neighboring countries of Romania, like Ukraine, like Moldova, there must be strong connections in your feelings about the destiny of Romania, becoming a member of the EU, become a member of NATO, because these countries have had a similar history in the sense of being oppressed by the Soviet Union in the Warsaw Pact. And this was in your younger years, in the Ceausescu period of Romania. What was life like then? What is your memory of Romania of those years?
Look, Romania was probably the most oppressive country in the communist bloc, and that says a lot.
So it was worse than Czechoslovakia?
Oh, yeah. It was much, much worse than Czechoslovakia. It was much worse than Poland or Hungary, where people could travel, they could study abroad. They had stuff to eat, you know. In the last years, I left Romania in 85, so I left under Ceausescu. You know, the queues to get basic foodstuffs like bread, butter, meat, milk, cooking oil, they were huge. You know, people were queuing up from 4 o'clock in the morning. They came with little stools and had a list of who was queuing up for what. And then, of course, things were rationed. So sugar, cooking oil were rationed. And we couldn't travel. It was very, very hard. And we were told, of course, that NATO, the European Union, were the enemy. So I grew up, you know, in a family of intellectuals. My mother was an ethnic German, actually. And so I would literally listen to foreign radio stations like the BBC, Voice of America, Deutsche Welle, under the bed covers, because I was afraid that my neighbors would hear the sound of the radio and report me to the secret police, the Securitate, because that was the sort of oppression, you know, neighbors spying on neighbors. It's very much, actually, if you look at what's happening in Russia today, that is the sort of oppressive atmosphere that I grew up in.
And the Ceausescu tribe, let's put it this, had a sort of Kim Il-sung and now Kim Jong-un sort of veneration, huh? Which was very particular for Romania.
Yeah, there was a sort of dynastic, you know, communist dynastic system, and they learned a lot from North Korea. I mean, Ceausescu visited North Korea and then came back with this idea of Juche, the self-reliance, so decided that Romania would pay back all its foreign debt and be independent from any Western influence, which, of course, led to this very dramatic deterioration in living standards in Romania.
So the hunger and scarcity in Romania was in order for the regime to pay off loans from the West.
Yeah, and to keep control over the population, because, of course, Romania under Ceausescu had this image of a sort of maverick communist regime that actually did not take part in the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Warsaw Pact troops in 68, and was trying to have it both ways. But, of course, this was just so it could oppress the population even more.
Now, you left halfway the 1980s. So you must have very strong memories of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Where were you? What was the moment you heard it?
I was actually in London, so I left Romania in 85. I went to Germany, where my mother was, and then I got a job at the BBC World Service, broadcasting to world audiences, and I started working with the Romanian service. And so the year 1989, of course, was a sort of year of grace, where things suddenly became possible with the first free elections in Poland, with groups of East Germans crossing from Hungary into Austria, and then, of course,
the collapse.
But I can tell you that, you know, we were talking with all our colleagues from all the various language services, also broadcasting to Central and Eastern Europe, and we still, those of us who came from Romania, we still did not expect that Ceausescu would fall. However, I remember working for the BBC and starting to interview dissidents who were in Romania at the time, which until then was absolutely impossible. Suddenly, we could call people up and record interviews with them. And that was a signal, because they were telling us, we're watching television, we know what's been happening in the Czech Republic, we know what's happening in Bulgaria, you know, we can see it happening. So we think it's going to happen. So that was a signal that there was something afoot and that all the dominoes would fall all the way to Romania.
Because Romania was, if you look at the happenings in the autumn of 89, the one country where you could say that the fall of the regime was very violent.
Yeah.
If you compare how the way Havel was sort of brought to the castle by all the young people, and even, of course, East Berlin, which was a miracle what happened, Romania was very violent.
Yeah, Romania was the only bloody revolution. Of course, there are still discussions to this day what exactly happened. Was it entirely a revolution? Was it a palace coup surfing on a revolutionary wave? And yeah, there are arguments actually for that, because if you look at what happened at the transition in Romania, of course, you had former members of the Communist Party coming into power, and the former Securitate officers who became the first capitalists, because they were the ones who had the passports, they had the ones who had the connections, they had the money. And so it was a complicated transition.
Yeah. So the complete story, maybe the true story, still has to be written.
Yeah, a lot has been written, but I think, there are still questions, even in my mind, about what exactly happened. And I think to some extent, I think probably the secret services, the Securitate, realized that the situation was untenable and that in order to keep themselves in power in some shape or form, they had to sacrifice Ceausescu and his family.
And of course, they did that very violently. I guess you also witnessed then, live on TV, more or less, the execution of Ceausescu and his wife.
Yeah, we were. I was in Bush House, the headquarters of the World Service. So I remember on that Christmas day, watching it on television. We had a feed of free Romanian TV, as it called itself in those days. And yes, it was strange, because, you know, listening to it in Romanian, we could see that the judges were talking to Ceausescu and his wife in the familiar you rather than the more polite version of the second person. So he thought, do these people know each other? So there was something there that was strange beyond, you know, the violence of the moment, of course, which is iconic in a way.
Yeah, this must have been for everyone who is Romanian, inside and outside, of course, a moment which struck you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and there was a lot of disinformation even then. Of course, disinformation has been with us for a long time, because I remember we were broadcasting to Romania from London, so we had to make very sure that we verified all our sources, which was not easy. Those were days of great confusion. There were a lot of urban myths about snipers. You may remember people killing protesters or civilians from rooftops, that the wells had been poisoned. So it was quite important for us that we stayed calm and cool and verified the information. And when we then went back to Romania, it was very gratifying to hear people who had been listening to us in those very, very difficult and confusing and violent moments to thank the BBC and, of course, other foreign radio stations, for the reassurance that we brought them and the hope.
Yeah. Now, you have also made a documentary on the Securitate and how it really functioned. Did you find and see your own dossier?
I did. I mean, I went back looking for my file of the secret police, the Securitate. It turned out that I had several files that I didn't know. So I had to go back again and again and to search in the Securitate archives with the help of historians and the people who are in charge of the archives now.
What was the name of your dossier?
Well, they had given me, Securitate had actually given me a code name, which was Lorena. I didn't know until I read the files, because what they were trying to do, so in the last years when I was in Romania, they were trying to recruit me as an informer, which happened to a lot of people who had relatives abroad, as I did.
Ah, you had your mother was
my
abroad.
My mother was in Germany.
So they had a sort of a grip
they
on
had
you.
A grip, yeah.
Oh, horrible.
So basically...
And you were a school teacher, maybe that
I was
a
school
also
teacher in... Yeah, I was a school teacher in a small provincial town in the mountains, and my father was dying of cancer. So they called me in, and they said, we can get you medicines for cancer, because, of course, there were no medicines in Romania at that time unless you had somebody abroad. So we can help you, but then you can tell us when you go to Germany, you can tell us about the people you meet, what they think about the government in Romania, you can just help us. And my father, who was a lawyer, even though he was dying, even though these were, perhaps, life-saving for him, said, don't sign anything, just don't allow yourself to be blackmailed. And, of course, he was right. And I said, look, I can't do this. This is not who I am. Do whatever you want. But, of course, I had no idea what would happen.
How easy was it for you yourself to leave Romania?
It took several years after my father died. So he died in 83 and I was able to leave in 85. By then, I had been sacked from the school where I was teaching because, of course, I could not indoctrinate the younger generation in any dangerous ideas as they saw them. So I was unemployed, at a time when there was no official unemployment in Romania. And eventually, they let me go in 85. But it was a lottery. You never knew what would happen if you said no to the Securitate. That was the fear was so strong and the uncertainty but it was the only option I had. And then, as you said, I went back and found the My Securitate files, and I saw that the moment I said no to them, they started tapping all my phone conversations with my mother, with everybody, basically, so I could see the transcripts, some written by hand, actually, some typewritten, in many, many different handwritings and from different typewriters. So you could see this whole bureaucracy of fear that they had. Basically, to spy on somebody was totally unimportant to.
Maybe also things you read that you were already forgotten yourself.
Totally, yeah. There were lots of conversations, with my mother, conversations that she had with my father, who was dying at the time.
They listened in while this...
Yeah, yeah. So
husband and wife were saying goodbye.
Yeah, and they were not able to see each other again. He couldn't leave and she couldn't come back. And so all of this was transcribed. So in a way, yeah, they did me a service, just to read those transcripts. But also I found letters, postcards that had been opened that I had never got, but they were in my file.
You said a bureaucracy of fear. It's interesting because Václav Havel, I think, was it who said that these regimes exist only for one reason, that's fear.
Yes, and of course fear is a powerful emotion, and none of us knows how we're going to react in any given situation where, you know, we have very little control over our own destiny.
When did you become fearful again about Russia? Was that already in the Yeltsin era, around Kosovo and Serbia, or was this later?
Look, I think if you come from Central and Eastern Europe, probably you're always fearful about Russia, because Russia is a revisionist power. Russia wants to recreate a sphere of influence, not necessarily even the Soviet Union, more the Russian Empire, because it may not be ideological as such. It's about the conquest of territory.
So it's part of their DNA.
It seems to be part of the DNA over many generations. But I think for many, many years after 89, NATO, and I would say the whole Western community, worked very hard to bring Russia into a partnership.
Yes.
Because everybody was trying very hard, and I'm always, I'm always a bit surprised when people say, well, we humiliated Russia. Actually, what happened was that Russia received a lot of economic support. There was support for Russia to join the WTO, to join the G7. There was a lot of support for Russia, you know, to retake its place as a normal, civilized democracy.
And there also were Russian diplomats on a daily basis in the NATO headquarters.
Yes, absolutely. There was a mission, because Russia was a partner to NATO. And when I became NATO spokesperson back in 2010, actually at the Lisbon summit, we had a NATO-Russia council with then-President Medvedev, who was taking part in the summit on the same footing as everybody else around the table.
And everybody, of course, remembers the very brotherly images of Helmut Kohl and Boris Yeltsin, even in the Banya. And, of course, Clinton and Yeltsin having such a big laugh that they couldn't stop laughing together.
Yeah, I think there was a genuine effort. However,
And those days, Medvedev was seen as one of the most soft-spoken guys.
Yeah, modern liberal.
A modern liberal, exactly. Yeah. However, if you look back, it's very interesting to look back at the archives now. And some of the archives, for instance, from 1999, from the Clinton years, have been declassified. And there is a fascinating conversation between Yeltsin and Clinton on the margins of the OSCE summit in Istanbul in 99, which I actually covered, and where, of course, Yeltsin promised to withdraw his troops from Moldova and Georgia. Never happened. But the conversation went like this. Yeltsin told Clinton, "Bill, give Europe to us. Give Europe to Russia. You're not, the United States is not a European power. We are both a European and an Asian power." And Clinton says, "So you want Asia too?" And Yeltsin, I'm quoting from memory here, and Yeltsin says, "Well, we'll discuss that, but give Europe to us. We will provide all the security arrangements that they need."
What did Yeltsin mean by this?
It's hard to say, but I think, we can't ask him now. But clearly, it's the sort of mindset that Russia had, that they need to retain a sphere of influence and a right of veto over the path that the countries of Europe choose. And it's interesting, he didn't say, give us the Baltics or give us Central and Eastern Europe. He said, Europe. So I think this is the sort of mindset of Russia, whether it had a more democratic, liberal, reformist leadership or a very clearly authoritarian leadership as we have now with Putin.
As a historian, it immediately reminds me of Tsar Alexander I, who, when Napoleon invaded, said, well, this is liberal Europe invading Holy Mother Russia. Will even burn Moscow if necessary, to combat them. And then said, well, my troops, my horses, my Tatars, they will, and Cossacks, they will go to Paris. And yeah. And we will rearrange Europe for us. And that's how I learned it from my grandma, Catherine the Great, who also thought in those geopolitical terms. Mm-hmm. And what you say is that Yeltsin, as a post-Soviet leader, sort of came back to that kind of thinking.
I think it's worth checking out, you know, you just need to check out, you know, Yeltsin Clinton 99 and you'll find the conversation online. So these are the US transcripts, the notes from those meetings.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
You were correspondent also at NATO and the European Union. Then in 2010, you became spokesperson of NATO. Did you sometimes feel some of your colleagues as being naive concerning Russia?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think in particular in 2014, after the illegal annexation of Crimea by Russia, I remember some of the discussions that we were having, you know, late at night, at the weekend in the North Atlantic Council, where with the ambassadors, where some were asking even then, but how do we know that those men in uniforms without insignia are actually Russian soldiers? I thought, well, if we don't know that now, then we don't want to see it. Because, of course, if you don't see it, you don't have to do anything about it. But the reality is that in 2014, I think that was a shock and a surprise to a large extent. But by 21, 22, NATO was not surprised. I think NATO prepared and saw what was coming with the full-fledged invasion, which was basically a continuation of the war that Russia had started against Ukraine in 2014. And then we were able to call it out and to warn people about what was going to happen.
Although NATO is an organization working with a consensus, the United States is the leading country. What were your personal thoughts when Donald Trump came in?
NATO obviously is an alliance now of 32 countries from both sides of the Atlantic, and it can only work by consensus of all allies, regardless of who's in government at any given time. There are elections practically every day in one of the allied countries. So NATO can't afford to be partisan about how it does its business. Yeah. It has to take
into account. And in the end, you are a civil servant working there.
Exactly. There's, you know, these are democracies. In democracies, things happen. Lots of people get elected, whom we may personally like or dislike. But that, frankly, doesn't make any difference to how NATO has to operate. So the United States has obviously always been a key ally in NATO, and it remains, and I'm sure it will continue to be.
One day, Donald Trump came in, but before that, were the Americans not already changing their minds from Europe to other places in the world?
Sort of moving away to an even wider global perspective and say, and sort of, well, Europe, we've done that. We've been there.
The United States will always be a global power. And of course, they have global reach. So that is a different perspective. But I think it's also important for us in Europe to realize that there is no such thing as regional security. And we see that perhaps better than ever now. You know, the European theater and the Asian theater are totally interrelated. The same thing with the Middle East. If you see the impact of the conflict in the Middle East, for instance, on attitudes in the American elections, but also we may think we have the luxury of saying, no, this is the Euro-Atlantic area and we're not going to look at what's happening in the Indo-Pacific. We're not going to look very closely at what China is doing. But that's not how Russia and China see it. And I think it's worth remembering that just days before Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, on the margins of the Beijing Olympics, Putin and President Xi signed a partnership with no limits, as they made clear, where for the first time, China said that it was opposed to NATO enlargement. So we may think that we're nothing to do with China, but that's not how China sees us.
And very, I also remember to say this, if Dutch or Europeans talk like that, because we are used to that the last 75 years, we then immediately sort of forget that the last time, for instance, Dutch soldiers died was in Afghanistan. It was not in the Fulda Gap because the Soviet tanks were coming. It was in Afghanistan.
On the border with China.
Yeah, on the border with China. And China sees that. And of course China sees that. Mm-hmm. If the Chinese were doing that in, let's say, in Austria, the Dutch would see it.
But that, of course, was as a result of 9/11, when for the first time NATO invoked Article 5, its collective defense clause, to support the United States. So the Afghanistan mission was as a result of that. And even though we can, of course, discuss a lot about the lessons learned from Afghanistan, the reality is that there was no terrorist attack originating in Afghanistan on any of our countries. So the sacrifice of Dutch soldiers and so many other European, American and partner soldiers was not in vain.
No, but it's very interesting to see that already then, this global perspective that what you said is for the US, but it's also here.
Absolutely.
Even if we don't maybe immediately recognize it.
Yeah, also, if you look at the recent terrorist attack in Russia, that was ISIS-K that claimed responsibility for that. And there's lots of indications that that's exactly the case, possibly in retaliation for Putin's very strong support for Assad in Syria, going back over many years. And even though sometimes in the media you hear reports about how the United States were pulling out of Europe during the Trump administration, the reality is that actually the U.S. military presence in Europe increased rather than decreased.
Nowadays there are about 100,000 U.S. military in Europe.
Yeah.
But his words were different. He threatened to leave NATO maybe.
Donald Trump's rhetoric was indeed very different. It was quite challenging, quite tough in many ways. However, if you look at his underlying message, the message was not new. The message about Europeans needing to do more for their own defense is a very old message from American leadership, going all the way back to Eisenhower, John F. Kennedy, Barack Obama, President Biden as well. So,
and this year, it's 10 years ago that the Wells Pledge was done, meaning that all the member states should try to go to the 2% of the gross national product for defense.
Which is not a ceiling. But
floor. It's a floor, exactly. And that was the reinforcement of that Wales pledge.
Yeah, that was set in Vilnius.
That was made last summer at the Vilnius summit. You're absolutely right. So 10 years ago, all allies made this pledge that they would aim to reach 2% of GDP on defense within a decade. So we're now at the end of that decade. It's now 2024. And looking around, it's true that all allies have stopped the cuts and all allies have made significant increases. Actually, last year, defense spending across Europe, European allies and Canada, was 11% more. So that's very significant. And we expect, I think, about two-thirds of allies to reach 2% or more by the Washington summit. And I would hope that the Netherlands is also in that camp, because I think it's really important, especially for a country like the Netherlands, you keep your promises. That's important to to upkeep, you know, Pacta sunt servanda. You know, this is the basis of an international rules-based order. I think it's important for a trading nation. When you promise something, you do it. And I think the Netherlands plays a very key role as a founding member of NATO. But I think delivering on the 2% pledge, but also when it comes to the capabilities that the Netherlands needs to ensure as part of the NATO defense planning process, which applies to all allies, and the readiness of the forces, I think these things are important, not to please Donald Trump or Joe Biden or whoever is in the White House, but to make sure that we can keep our nation safe.
Yeah, talking about the Netherlands, many of our Dutch citizens suffered the downing of flight MH17. What did you do at NATO at that moment? Was there a task for NATO when that happened?
There was obviously there was a strong statement of solidarity, and I remember that.
Were you the one who wrote it?
I wrote it together with my team, and obviously with Secretary General Rasmussen. So there was a very strong statement of solidarity.
You were, of course, completely shocked because nobody could ever see this happening.
It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. And also what was even more unbelievable afterwards is the attempts by Russia to totally confuse the waters about what had happened. There was a new story every week. Every week. This shows you how Russian disinformation works. It's not about convincing you that this is what happened. It's about totally confusing you so that you believe that there's no truth. And in the end, you know, some may even deny it's happened. But of course, for all the families, the people who've lost loved ones, you know, this is such a horrific, horrific event. And it's very important to have accountability for that. But it also shows how, you know, conflict, war next door can affect us in a very direct and unexpected way, which is why it's so important that we continue to support Ukraine so that it is strong enough to be in a position to negotiate peace when it comes to that point. And I think that's also why it's so important. I think the Dutch people have also realized the importance of supporting Ukraine in this ongoing war.
Last week I was at the NATO headquarters. I heard some diplomats talking about the Rammstein format. The leaders and the military are getting together there to talk about how to help Ukraine in the best way. And now at NATO also, people are thinking about putting the Rammstein format over to NATO. Do you think that's a good idea?
Of course, all allies and many partners are members of the Rammstein group, the contact group for defense contact group for Ukraine. And NATO plays an important role.
But might that not be a red line for Putin?
I think, frankly, that it doesn't make, in reality, it doesn't make a huge difference. But what it does do, it creates a stronger institutional framework for running this mechanism rather than just leaving it to the US or another single country to administer that. So also, if you have concerns about changes in administration, it makes it easier and more predictable if this is run as part of an institution such as NATO.
Yeah, part of, let's say, the last 10, 15 years of Europe and NATO trying to sort of get a feel for the Russian regime, also even for President Putin himself, was, of course, that all the leaders tend to say, you, Angela, you know how to do this. You can talk to him in Russian, he can talk to you in German. And it was almost always Angela Merkel who was sort of put in front to try to get some feel about. And I remember that President Obama, when he left in 2016, that he said, poor Angela, she's all on her own now. Is there still the possibility sort of to get a feel for what is going on in the Kremlin? How do we do that? Because Angela is also gone.
I think, you know, this is not about reading people's minds. I think you need to look at the actions. And we see no indication, just on the contrary, that Putin is prepared to stop this horrific illegal war which he caused. We have to remember that, of course, it was he who invaded Ukraine, so he could stop the war today. So it's not about reading minds or having great psychological insights.
But being pessimistic is not the only thing we can do, I suppose.
No, I think we need to be vigilant, we need to be ready, we need to be prepared, we need to be strong, we need to be united. I think this is the best we can do.
But is it impossible to build a bridge to the Kremlin from Brussels?
This is what Brussels and I think all our capitals have tried to do for decades, both NATO and the European Union, the G7. So I think there were efforts until the very last minute. And again, you may remember that the NATO-Russia Council met in January 22, and that was a very deliberate effort by Secretary General Stoltenberg and all the allies around the table to engage Russia in a diplomatic process, in a dialogue, in a political dialogue. And then actually the Russian officials came to that meeting and just repeated their talking points that they had from Moscow. And they even showed us, I remember they showed us some maps of the Euro-Atlantic area where a lot of the countries geographies were sort of twisted. So there were parts of these countries that were not shown in blue as being part of NATO. And so at the end of this NATO-Russia Council, the Secretary General said, we'll send you some correct maps.
I'll give you an update on the geography.
And, you know, it's hard to understand whether this was a deliberate provocation. Maybe they thought that people wouldn't notice, or they just didn't care. But clearly, there was no commitment to any real political engagement. Every interview, every speech, every press conference that the Secretary General gave, and obviously we prepared those together and drafted them, there was a call to Russia to step back from the brink and to pull back its troops from the borders of Ukraine and to engage in a genuine dialogue. Those repeated calls went totally unheeded by Moscow, unfortunately.
For about 14 years, you were the spokesperson at NATO, also, and in the first place, of the Secretary General. What is a Secretary General? Is he a civil servant or is he a leader?
He's both. And he is somebody, or she, at some point, who has to create the consensus that makes NATO work. So all 32 members, as we are now, have to agree on a course of action. It's not always easy. It can be, you know, consensus building can be a bit messy. You have to be very patient. It may take quite a few meetings. But at the end, when that consensus is reached, there's much stronger will and ability to deliver on those decisions. And that's what's kept NATO successful for 75 years. It's that unity in defending each other and protecting each other, whatever the differences among these 32 countries may be. And the role of the Secretary General, of course, is absolutely key to that.
You say, whatever the differences. So this means that the Secretary General must be a good secretary, he must be a good general, but he must also have an immense empathy. He must be understanding with people from Romania and Turks and Portuguese and now also Finns.
Absolutely. Finns and Swedes. Mm-hmm. And that shows you, by the way, the importance and how unpredictable things can be in geopolitics and in politics, because who would have thought before Russia's invasion of Ukraine that Finland and Sweden would choose to join NATO? Because it was their choice when they saw that what Putin was trying to do was to remove their ability to choose their own path and to join NATO if they wanted to. That was inherent in the draft treaties which Putin proposed to NATO and the US, that there would be no more enlargement, not just not to Ukraine or Georgia, but Finland or Sweden or anybody else. So yes, absolutely. And that is, of course, that is a total strategic defeat for Putin. He wanted less NATO. He's got stronger NATO and more NATO. But the role of the NATO Secretary General is, of course, yes, to be a good listener. It helps that Jens Stoltenberg, like Anders Fogh Rasmussen before him, were prime ministers who led a lot of coalition governments. Because in many ways, you know, this is a coalition where every party has its own interests.
Sometimes and even a small party, you must give
absolutely.
Them their due. You must
absolutely.
You must talk to Luxembourg.
Yes.
And but also to France.
Everybody has a voice, and everybody has to be part of the consensus.
About a year ago, I visited your deputy, and he told me there is no word, no sentence that comes from the mouth of the Secretary General that didn't go through our bureaucracy. That must be very boring for a Secretary General.
The way to understand that is that the Secretary General, of course, has to speak for the whole alliance. However, he also has to be a leader and he has to show the way. And that may not always be 100% popular. But for instance, when it comes to the importance of China and dealing with the challenge of China, I think Secretary General Stoltenberg was ahead perhaps of some of the allies in putting that on the agenda through speeches, for instance, or interviews, because it was something that was really important.
So you have to be able to put steps forward.
Yeah, you need to be able to do both. You need to be a political leader, you know, wanting to move the alliance forward so that it's not just the lowest common denominator, because this is a world which is so dangerous, it's so unpredictable that we cannot just be stopped by, you know, bureaucratic discussions and committees. So the Secretary General's messages are not negotiated. You know, it's for him to take the responsibility for what he says. But of course, they have to be in line with the emerging consensus in the alliance. So it's a balancing act. And it's not always easy, but I think, we've managed to strike the right note most of the time.
I heard the comparison made that the Secretary General of NATO, in that sense, looks most in his functioning like Christine Lagarde or Mario Draghi. They must be very, very clear in what they say, but also sometimes a bit mysterious. But everybody must think, aha, that's how it is going.
Yeah, you need to keep some sort of strategic ambiguity in what you say, because that's also part of deterrence. We're not going to explain exactly when Article 5 applies and when it doesn't apply. You know, there has to be that uncertainty in the mind of any potential adversary, but there also has to be the certainty that the consequences for any aggression would be so high that they don't even try.
Strategic ambiguity. I'll keep that in mind.
It's part of deterrence.
The Secretary General has to build a relationship with, of course, all the 32 members, but especially he has to have a good relationship with the United States President. How does he or she build such a relationship?
He or she at the Secretary General needs to have a good relationship with everybody. You know, they can't just have a very good relationship with the United States, but not with the other 31 allies. That's not how it works. Of course, a lot depends on experience, on professionalism. And, you know, if there's one thing that I've learned in my rather long life in journalism and then as NATO spokesperson, is that the personalities matter. People matter, right? It matters who is there in a particular position.
For example, Anders Fogh Rasmussen with Barack Obama, how was their relationship?
They had a good working relationship. I remember that we went to the Chicago summit and actually
I love Chicago.
Yes, oh. Anders Fogh Rasmussen, one of his sons actually lives in Illinois. So and his grandchildren are half American. So I remember that we got for the breakfast with President Obama a root beer float, because he knew that that was the favorite of Anders Fogh Rasmussen when he came to Chicago. So, yeah, it's also about small gestures like this.
This also has to do with what I before said, empathy, sort of getting the feel of that person.
Yeah, you need to be able to read the room, as they say, and to listen. I think a lot of the political leaders who are successful and effective are also good listeners. It's a bit like, you know, a good journalist, right? You don't just talk. You also have to listen to what the other side.
You have to have three ears. Huh?
The
third ear.
Oh, yes. Now I notice. Yes. I see you do.
Yeah. So what was, for instance, an important, let's say, aspect of Barack Obama as a president that Mr. Rasmussen said, this is something I now understand. This is something I know now.
I think like all American presidents, Barack Obama was very interested in the economy. You know, is the economy stupid? And I think that's the case with a lot of our leaders. So, for instance, you know, Anders Fogh Rasmussen was an economist and a politician, and Jens Stoltenberg is a statistician and a politician. So the fact that, you know, he's so focused on figures and is very focused on getting the figures right, whether it's about 2% or, you know, climate change emissions, whatever it is, that's also part of who he is. And so that gives them credibility, that they know what they're talking about and they're not just going to, you know, to come up with a policy or some statistics that are just, you know, taken out of a hat.
You said that listening is very important for Secretary General. So when Donald Trump came in, Jens Stoltenberg started listening.
He always listens.
But sometimes it's also important to say something back. When did that happen and how did that happen with Trump?
I mean, if you listen, if you watch some of the videos, I think the Secretary General was always very clear about the position of the alliance, and also making sure that there was not something said about an ally that was incorrect or that could be misinterpreted.
For instance, about Germany.
So we had again a famous breakfast with President Trump before a summit in Brussels in 2018, where there were statements by Donald Trump about Germany and its position towards Russia and Nord Stream 2. With hindsight, you could say that he wasn't wrong when it came to the dependency that Europe and Germany had on Nord Stream 2.
But it was surprising that he would say it.
It was in language which of course was quite shocking. So the Secretary General, you know, had to explain that this was a national economic decision at the time by Germany, but also to move the discussion onto the issues that were actually on the agenda of the summit and the contributions that Germany and other allies made to the security of the alliance. So, yeah, I mean, obviously it's a give and take. These conversations are not necessarily easy. These are tough decisions, and there may not be any good option.
In NATO circles, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte is sometimes called the Trump whisperer, and that also is because he told Trump not to be angry on the member states, because many member states already spent much more on defense than they did 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and that Trump should
claim this victory.
Exactly. And he did, Trump.
John Bolton wrote in his book that when Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said that Trump sort of this appeal to his TV personality thing, van, oh, I can claim I'm a hit. I have a, you know, it's a great success. I can tell a success story.
Hmm. Yeah, I think Prime Minister Rutte played an important role at that summit in 2018 when the Secretary General actually called an extraordinary session of the North Atlantic Council of the leaders to discuss defense spending. I think it was important to acknowledge the progresses that had been made, which were clear, but also that there was a sense of urgency in fulfilling the pledge, which again was true. So I think you have to give credit where credit is due, regardless of how much you may personally like or dislike a particular politician, because I think at the end it's about the issues, you know, and what makes NATO stronger at the end of the day.
Can I ask a very pointed question? After President Trump, we had President Biden. And what is most surprising about President Biden is that he said to Jens Stoltenberg, I want you to stay. Why was that?
You'd have to ask President Biden. But of course, this is now the Secretary General has been extended for an unprecedented four times. So he is the longest serving Secretary General in the history of NATO, with the exception of Josef Luntz, of course, a Dutchman in a very different period, right? In the 80s. I think there was a recognition that Secretary General Stoltenberg has been extremely skilled in keeping the alliance together at the most dangerous time in its history since the Cold War, and that's not easy. And also that at a time when Europe is at war, it was important to maintain a sense of clarity, continuity, and strength at the helm of NATO.
And obviously, Biden sort of recognizes that in Mr. Stoltenberg.
Yes, I think practically everybody recognizes that in Jens Stoltenberg. I think he is a remarkable leader, and he was the man that NATO needed right now. And I would also say that without Jens Stoltenberg, I think it would have been much harder to get Finland and Sweden joining, which is a huge geostrategic achievement. But without his experience and his personal experience over many, many years with President Erdogan, Prime Minister Orban, and the leaders over several governments of Finland and Sweden, that would have been much harder. So he was absolutely the right man in the right place at the right time.
What were his role models? Because, you know, you are a Secretary General, you're a very long time. So probably in history, he would say, when I think of certain situations, I think of, say, Lord Ismay, or I think of Josef Luntz. Who were his role models?
I would strongly recommend that you listen to a radio program that he did with the BBC called Desert Island Discs a couple of years
That's
ago.
That's about music.
Which is also music, but it's also a great conversation. So he was asked some of these questions, and it's a great listen. So if I may plug a BBC program on this podcast.
As a former BBC journalist.
But and I think his models were more, you know, in his own family. So his models were his parents. And he often tells a story about how as a child around the breakfast table, you know, his father or his mother would invite revolutionary leaders from Africa, from South Africa, for instance, freedom fighters, politicians from around the world, and they would make some not very good coffee and, you know, some toast with brown cheese, you know, Norwegian brown cheese, and discuss politics. So I think that was the education for him. Also about, you know, bringing people together again and listening to their stories, trying to understand where they came from and what drove them. And that's the sort of politician he is. He's a people's politician.
Hello, Ik ben Claudia de Breij. Ik ben een vaste luisteraar van Betrouwbare Bronnen. En daarom ben ik ook vriend van de show geworden. Sindsdien is mijn leven aanzienlijk verbeterd. Dus wil jij dat ook? En wil je Jaap en PG echt helpen met het maken van nog meer zulke goede afleveringen? Ga dan nu naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. Doe het niet straks, doe het nu.
Let's go back to 2021. At the very moment, the United States were very open about Russia planning to attack Ukraine. Many Europeans didn't believe that. Did you?
Yes. But I must say that when I heard the first briefings back in October, November 21, that what Russia was planning was to take Kiev and decapitate the Ukrainian government, I felt a punch to the gut, because that was much more than some had been expecting, you know, in terms of the ambition of this aggression.
So you were shocked?
Yeah, absolutely.
This was a surprise?
This was a surprise. However, remember, the year 2021, the background for that was that Russia had already built up its presence on the borders of Ukraine at the beginning of the year, and then had sort of saying, oh, this is about an exercise that we're doing. And then they had drawn down to a certain extent, but had left a lot of equipment in place. And throughout that year, NATO, like the US and other allies, would call on Russia to withdraw their troops and equipment. And once we started getting the briefings, which were very dramatic about what Russia was planning to do and the capabilities that it was bringing to Ukraine's borders, we took a decision, a deliberate decision, to declassify an unprecedented amount of intelligence that NATO had.
That had never been done before. Huh?
Never to that extent, no. Never.
What was the reason for this?
Well, the reason was to try to avoid the sort of surprise that we had back in 2014. Also to create among our public opinions, but also among political leaders, and to create the sense of unity that was needed to move forward in such a dangerous situation. And of course, to try to avoid it, if at all possible, but that did not lie in NATO's hands. It lied in Putin's hands. So from the autumn of 21 onwards until the very last minute, the Secretary General, through everything that he said publicly, would expose the sort of capabilities that Russia was bringing, the numbers, the types of weaponry, and the plans that we knew Russia had. And I think that was really absolutely key to forging the unity, which was unprecedented in the wake of Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, because everybody understood what was going on and understood the stakes.
When the war started, what were your thoughts about President Zelensky? I mean, he was a comedian.
He won Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, but he wasn't, you know, he was the president, and we had seen him as the president, you know. That's, frankly, I didn't know that he went Dancing with the Stars. I don't think that was
Were you surprised by the way he handled the war?
I think everybody was really impressed by President Zelensky's determination. I remember we saw him at the Munich Security Conference just before the invasion. And nobody knew what was going to happen. You know, would he go back? So I think the fact that he showed such tremendous leadership, and still does to this day, as we enter the third year of Russia's illegal war in Ukraine, shows again the importance of strong, determined leadership, especially in a crisis situation, a terrible situation such as this, but at all times.
When will Ukraine join NATO as a member?
That is a decision, of course, for the allies. So as they said at the Vilnius summit last year, Ukraine's future is in NATO, and Ukraine will join when conditions are met and allies agree. What has happened in the last year is that Ukraine is now closer to NATO than ever before. There is a NATO-Ukraine Council, which also meets in crisis situations. We've had a recent briefing just a few days ago about, for instance, the wave of attacks on civilian infrastructure by Russia in Ukraine. We also have an increased package of assistance for Ukraine. And for the first time, the Ukraine's road to NATO is one step shorter, because NATO leaders removed the requirement for a so-called membership action plan before Ukraine joins.
Some NATO member states, especially in the east of Europe, say, let's get those Ukrainians in NATO today.
That, of course, is a decision that has to be taken by all allies by consensus, as with everything else in NATO. But I think there is a clear understanding that support for Ukraine is absolutely vital for Ukraine, but also for our own security. Because if Putin wins in Ukraine, the risk is that he will not stop there. And the message that is given, not just to Putin, but to other autocratic regimes around the world, will be that you can achieve your objectives by using force.
When Ukraine joins NATO, does Moldova also join, maybe on the same day?
But that is a decision for Moldova. And Moldova is a partner to NATO, a long-standing partner to NATO. It hasn't applied to join NATO, but we have a long-standing history and experience of helping to train Moldovan forces, helping them reform their armed forces, helping build greater resilience.
So there are already a sort of strong partnership.
It's a very strong partnership. Actually, as we've had, as NATO's had with all countries of the former Soviet Union, including and starting with Russia.
With Russia
but
itself.
That is, of course, no longer the case.
Yeah. And as a Romanian, of course, you feel even more close to Moldova, I guess.
Well, I was in Moldova. Obviously, I followed Moldova very, very closely because Moldova used to be part of Romania in its history. The language is Romanian. I have many friends there, and I was there on the day Moldova declared independence, and that was again another extraordinary moment in post-Soviet history. Just to see, the streams of old-fashioned buses, coming from the villages with people waving the tricolor flag. That is a moment that goes down in history. And, of course, it shows that however big or small a country is, it has the right to choose its own path. And that is enshrined in all European security documents, all of them signed by Russia. So this idea that somehow Russia has a right to impose its own views on others is absolutely wrong.
By the end of September, Jens Stoltenberg will leave as Secretary General. What will be the greatest challenge for the next Secretary General?
I think for NATO, what is at stake is always unity. Unity is always our greatest strength. If Europe and North America stand together, we can deal with any challenge. And there are many challenges that we have to deal with. And that's why any, Russia or any potential adversary will always target our unity. And sometimes they don't have to do that much, because it depends on us also to be vulnerable, to be divided. And so it's important that we're also strong and united and resilient as countries, as nations. So, I think it's going to be obviously, it's going to be a daunting task for anybody who is NATO Secretary General after Jens Stoltenberg.
You have to emulate him.
Well, not necessarily, but you have to be able to maintain consensus, to maintain unity, to make the alliance even stronger, because the sort of challenges that we face are not going away. So you need to be patient and resilient and vigilant.
You left NATO not so long ago. Was the reason to leave because Jens Stoltenberg was leaving?
Yes and no. I had been doing the job for 13 years, which is the longest any NATO spokesperson has done.
And you're the Josef Lunz of spokespersons.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's relentless. So after a while, I think it's also important, and I felt it was important for me to, you know, take control a bit of my own time and my own life, rather than always, you know, being dependent on what either Jens Stoltenberg does or what, you know, Joe Biden thinks that Jens Stoltenberg should be doing. So I thought, okay, I think it's good to leave on a high.
If you were asked for advice by the next Secretary General, what would be the greatest mistake she or he must avoid?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I have a brilliant piece of advice. Yeah, I think you just need to listen and understand that everybody will have their national interests. But at the end of the day, what keeps NATO together is that every country understands the importance of standing together.
There are two names still mentioned. Let's talk about Klaus Johannes. Which qualifications does the Romanian president have for the job?
I'm not going to be the proponent of either candidate. I think, you know, they're both
but you must know
strong
him.
Leaders.
I know Johannes.
I know both Klaus Johannes and Mark Rutte, of course.
What kind of a man is Klaus Johannes? Because in Holland, I'm surprised nobody knows.
Nobody knows. Yeah, he's an unusual politician in that, you know, he's an ethnic German from Transylvania who brought, I think, an image of probity. You know, he's a sort of the anti-corruption type of president.
Very serious.
Yeah. Yes, very very serious. And I think quite, you know, quite determined in terms of again navigating Romania's course in difficult times.
And what's his main qualification?
I think that would be for Romania to, you know, I'm not a spokesperson for either Klaus Johannes or for Romania.
You once were a journalist, and now you're working in a think tank.
Yeah.
So you have to watch all the candidates and think about them and their pluses and their minuses.
Look, ultimately, the key qualification for any Secretary General is to make sure that they create consensus. That's a requirement. That's a decision for the other heads of state and government to make. You know, it won't be, you know, there's a lot of speculation in the media. Ultimately, the people who decide are the other heads of state and government.
And they will probably think of their own experiences with those persons in, hey, this guy, it's men, this guy, I have seen him work, you know, work the room, get a consensus, get this little problem out of the way, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it will rely on the experience that everybody has with specific candidates and on their ability to bring different perspectives together in a way that makes sense and move things forward.
The Americans already favored Mark Rutte before the Romanians nominated Klaus Johannes. Was that a diplomatic failure of the Americans?
I think the position of the United States was well known for quite some time, actually. I would say
But the Americans also went out in the open with it.
Yeah, but I think the United States had made clear that Mark Rutte was their favorite candidate. I think they had approached Prime Minister Rutte several times before. Of course, the Netherlands had elections and he was not ready to be a candidate. So, of course, you know, these things can change with time, and they're fine judgments to be made by any politician. But no, I don't see why it would be a mistake of American diplomacy, because their position was well known among allies.
When do you expect consensus?
I would hope that consensus comes sooner rather than later, because I think it's really important that the decision is taken well before the European elections, so that we don't see any further delays with all the negotiations for the next leaders of the various European institutions.
Also, that it would complicate the various position
it
sort
could,
of exchanges between countries within the EU who it, are also NATO countries.
It could potentially delay things, and I think it's quite important that we have clarity sooner rather than later, also before the American election campaign kicks into higher gear. Because again, I think these are discussions and decisions that should be above partisan politics and should not get dragged into partisan politics. There has to be consensus on NATO, because that goes beyond that sort of party political decisions.
So at the 75 festival in Washington, there should not be an unclarity.
It's a summit, not a festival, in Washington in July. And I think, you know, it's not just going to be about, you know, celebrating things. It's much more about, you know, making sure the alliance stays strong and united and continues to adapt. So I would say that, yeah, at the latest by the Washington summit, but I would hope much sooner.
Nevertheless, we have to celebrate 75 years of NATO. The big thing will be in Washington in July. Isn't that a very good moment for Vladimir Putin for a big strike?
You know, Vladimir Putin has launched lots of big strikes all the time, finding all sorts of excuses for them. So I think we always need to be prepared, whatever the moment.
May we thank you for this very interesting conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Zo, dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 413. Deze aflevering is mede mogelijk gemaakt door de Atlantische Commissie en natuurlijk door de vrienden van de show. Wil jij ons ook helpen? Ga dan naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb.
Jaap, jij was toch heel recent deze dagen in Brussel?
Klopt, afgelopen week was ik een paar dagen in het NAVO-hoofdkwartier om met diplomaten te praten.
En die waren natuurlijk heel diplomatiek tegenover jou, maar ik verwacht eigenlijk dat jij wel toch interessante dingen hebt gehoord.
Nou ja, iedereen in Nederland zit natuurlijk te kijken hoe gaat dat verder met die kandidatuur van Mark Rutte.
En je hoorde Wana Lungescu ook al heel voorzichtig, maar ze hinten wel, maar je merkte het is allemaal nog heel teer.
Ja, en er is natuurlijk nog steeds ook Klaus Johannes als kandidaat. En dat betekent dat er gewoon nog geen consensus is. Dus daar moeten we echt op wachten. Een van de bezwaren die tegen de Nederlandse kandidaat zijn ingebracht de afgelopen tijd is dat Nederland nog steeds niet aan de 2% defensieuitgaven zit. 2% van het bruto nationaal product.
En je hoorde mevrouw Lungescu zeggen, hè, pacta sunt servanda. Een handelsland dat zijn belofte niet nakomt, heeft dus als handelsland ook een probleem. Dat was een heel puntige opmerking voor een toch vrij diplomatieke dame.
Nou hoorde ik in Brussel dat destijds, 10 jaar geleden, in Wales is afgesproken om zo dicht mogelijk richting de 2% te gaan in 2024. Daar zitten we dus nu in.
En daar wees deze dagen ook Hanke Bruinslot op, dat Nederland er net niet zei, ze zitten voor, maar we doen ons best, want dat moet toch kunnen.
Nederland, als je nu naar de cijfers kijkt, de tabellen, dan zie je ook dat Nederland het tegenaan duwt, tegen die 2%, maar nog net niet gehaald. Maar Bij de NAVO zijn ze wat optimistischer over Nederland, gek genoeg. Dat verbaasde me, want daar gaat al een tabel rond sinds januari, waarin zo'n prognose wordt gedaan van alle lidstaten en hoe zit het met die 2% per lidstaat.
Dus ze kijken als aan in de meerjarenramingen van de begrotingen.
Ja, en er wordt ook een beetje gekeken van hoe verhouden de uitgaven, die miljarden, die ook flink zijn toegenomen de afgelopen jaren, zich tot de stand van de economie. Terug is natuurlijk een beetje, gaat het slechter met de economie, dan geef je meteen relatief meer uit aan defensie.
En valt het allemaal mee, dan hang je voor de net onder die 2%.
Ja, en met Nederland gaat het natuurlijk best wel goed nog steeds economisch. Maar goed, de prognose op dit moment is dat Nederland op 2,17% uit kan komen dit jaar.
Dat is wel grappig, mevrouw Longescu, die zei dus, ja, Stoltenberg, een van zijn bijzondere kwaliteiten is, hij is een statistiek student geweest. Hij wist dol op cijfertjes en tabellen, en, hè, waarin hij dus wat verschilde van de econoom Rasmussen. Ik hoor hier eigenlijk ook de statistiekman Stoltenberg die het achter de komma wil zien hoe het zit.
Ja, ik ben heel benieuwd. Misschien dat straks bij de voorjaarsnota duidelijk wordt. Of in ieder geval voor de top in Washington. Dan zal de complete tabel van alle NAVO-lidstaten wel openbaar worden gemaakt. Hoe Nederland er dan voor staat. Maar het lijkt dus de goede kant op te gaan. En dat argument, Nederland voldoet er niet aan, dat vervalt dan.
Dan wordt dat dus sterk gerelativeerd.
Ja, ik hoorde ook in Brussel dat Rutte al vrij lang geleden gepolst is door Joe Biden, al in januari 2023.
Dus door Biden zelf?
Ja.
Dat is natuurlijk heel significant, want een president van de Verenigde Staten zal in zo'n proces van het zoeken naar iemand niet meteen zelf zijn nek enorm uitsteken. Dat weten we ook toen van met Clinton en dat Lubbers kandidaat was en uiteindelijk dus niet werd. Dus het feit dat Biden zelf initieerd is naar een premier binnen de NAVO is heel veelzeggend.
Ja, alleen toen kon Rutte eigenlijk niet anders, ook gezien het Nederlandse staatsrecht, dan zeggen ja, sorry Joe, maar ik leid een kabinet, ik ben niet beschikbaar.
We hebben nu net een jaar, Rutte 4, kon hij hem uitleggen.
Nou, toen heeft Joe het voor dat gesprek het er even bij laten zitten. Maar hij heeft toen wel meteen contact gezocht met Emmanuel Macron, de president van Frankrijk.
Die dacht, er is nog een andere liberaal in Europa. Hè? Ook van de Renew Club binnen het Europese politiek. En dat is toevallig de president en de enige in de EU die en een veto heeft in de Veiligheidsraad en zijn eigen atoombom. En dus ook graag een beetje erop voorstaat, hè, dat Frankrijk een beetje meer is dan eigenlijk elk ander lid van de NAVO.
Ja, en Joe Biden dacht wellicht, mogelijk begrijpt Emmanuel beter hoe die Nederlandse politiek met die coalities in elkaar zit en zo. Dus Macron ging het opnieuw aan Rutte vragen. En opnieuw zei Rutte, ja, sorry Emmanuel, maar ik heb een kabinet te leiden. En toen viel het kabinet, het Nederlandse kabinet. Toen was inmiddels al de Deense met de Frederiksen als alternatief op het tapijt verschenen. Maar daar was Rishi Sunak, de premier van het Verenigd Koninkrijk, niet tevreden mee. Die zei, wij hebben ook een kandidaat, namelijk Ben Wallace, onze minister van Defensie.
En ja, die is natuurlijk politiek bepaald van andere kleur dan de rode mevrouw Frederiksen. En Sunak die wil natuurlijk niet een Labour mevrouw, ook nog een mevrouw, hè, aan de kop van de NAVO als hij dat kan voorkomen. En Wallace had en heeft een uitstekende reputatie, hè, onder de collega's.
Kortom, ze kwamen er niet uit. En toen heeft Joe Biden besloten, laten we dan Stoltenberg gewoon een extra jaar geven. Moesten ze hem nog wel om vragen, want Stoltenberg had eigenlijk al lang weg willen zijn.
Hij was zijn koffer al 2 keer eerder aan het pakken geweest, geloof ik, hè.
En ondertussen is ook nog Kaya Kallas op het toneel verschenen als kandidaat. Maar je hoort toch wel bij de NAVO, zij is nooit echt serieus als kandidaat beschouwd. Want zij zit natuurlijk ook in een land dat grenst aan Rusland. En ja, zij is te veel havik om misschien al die verschillende stemmen, al die verschillende tones of voice in het NAVO-bondgenootschap te kunnen handelen.
Ja, je hoorde ook van Juana Longescu dat ze zei, ja, je moet en, hè, zoals Stoltenberg, om kunnen gaan met een Erdogan, maar ook met een Orbán. En ja, als je natuurlijk de premier bent van een kleine Baltische staat die zo onder druk staat, want dat is zo. Zo onder druk, hè, op echte cyberoorlogen al meer dan 1 keer vanuit Rusland. Dan is het wel lastig om dan te zeggen, ja, maar ik ga heel begripvol nu praten met Viktor Orbán.
Ja.
Ik vond ook opmerkelijk van Oana Lungescu dat ze toch een beetje midden hield van, ja, het moet eigenlijk liever een beetje snel. En we willen ook eigenlijk niet verknoopt raken in het hele gedoe met de opvolging van Charles Michel en Borrell en
die baan in Europa. Viel meer trouwens op, nog wel een paar keer meer in het gesprek, dat ze hier ook weer even echt de woordvoerder was.
Daar was het ook zo. Is het ook zo'n boeiende vrouw? Ze zit er helemaal in nog. Hè? Die is helemaal niet blasé of absoluut niet.
Nee, maar het klopt wat Oana Lungescu zegt. De Europese verkiezingen en die hele kermis van al die functies die dan weer verdeeld moeten worden. Ja, daar willen ze heel graag voor zijn. Want anders gaat het in elkaar interfereren.
Wat ook weer aangeeft dat dus, denk nou eens 10, 15 jaar geleden. Dus de Amerikaanse president in zijn strategische besluitvorming rond zelfs topbenoemingen rekening houdt met de uitslag van de Europese verkiezingen. Dan zie je dus hoe belangrijk die Europese verkiezingen ook geworden zijn, Jaap. Gewoon als een geopolitiek verschijnsel.
Eigenlijk hadden ze het ook om die reden deze week al rond willen hebben, de benoeming van de nieuwe secretaris-generaal.
Maar dat is niet gebeurd.
Dat is dus niet gelukt. Dat gaat dus op een ander moment gebeuren. Uiteindelijk het officiële moment gebeurt niet onder leiding van de oude secretaris-generaal. Die zit daar dan niet bij. Een Kroaat zal die vergadering leiden. Want de Kroaat is op dit moment de oudste in dienstjaren aan die tafel in de NAVO-raad.
Wat eigenlijk ook weer iets heel moois heeft. Dat is ook een van die landen die dus er zo laat en vanuit het Oost-Europese communistische bewind erbij gekomen zijn. En die mag dat dan voorzitten.
Ja, maar dat moment zal waarschijnlijk niet het moment zijn dat wij horen, er is een nieuwe secretaris-generaal. Dat komt waarschijnlijk plotseling uit de lucht vallen.
Een soort Vaticaanse habemus secretaris-generaal.
Ja, als ergens die consensus ontstaan is.
En dat witte rook.
De meest vreemde momenten plotseling gebeuren.
Dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Tot volgende keer.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Janssen in samenwerking met dag-en-nacht.nl.